Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
The Presidencies of the United States is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. Hello and welcome to the Presidencies of the United States. I'm your host, Jerry Landry. This is the second of our two-part episode on the life of Richard Rush as part of the Seat at the Table special series. Before we get into the episode, I wanted to take this opportunity to again thank my special guest, Alicia, the host of the Civics and Coffee podcast, for joining me for this episode. If you haven't checked it out already, Civics and Coffee is a great podcast covering various aspects of American history from the very beginning on through to the present day. In short, succinct episodes meant to be enjoyed in the time it takes you to drink a cup of coffee or tea or whatever drink you'd like, Alicia helps us to explore the individuals and the events that make up American history. It's one of my go-to podcasts, and I cannot recommend it enough. Likewise, with Alicia, it is always great to talk with her. She brings such insight and perspective to any conversation. So I cannot recommend her work enough. Go and check her out, Civics and Coffee, wherever you get your podcast. I'll have a link on the page for this episode on my website, presidenciespodcast.com. So be sure to check that out. Now, without further ado, after these messages, we'll pick back up where we left off with Richard Rush's life as he came back to the U.S. to assume the role of Secretary of the Treasury in the administration of John Quincy Adams.
A news story gets shared by a friend on social media, or you catch a tweet that really makes your blood boil. But how do you separate fact from fiction? That's the premise behind Disinformation, a 10-part series from Evergreen Podcasts and Emergent Risk International coming this fall. Tune in to Disinformation wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, don't believe everything you read.
Now, I will say that Rush was not Adams' first choice as Secretary of the Treasury. The president-elect had first approached William Crawford, who had been Monroe's Secretary of the Treasury, and of course had also been the third highest vote getter in the presidential election. But due to his ill health, even though it was the political thing to do to offer for him to remain in the post, Adams was kind of reluctant to do so, but did so anyway. It also didn't help that Crawford had fallen out with Monroe at the end of his tenure. All this in play, the Georgian decided the time had come to return home, and so thus he declined Adams' offer to continue on in the post. And you have to imagine Adams probably did a quick sigh of relief before deciding, okay, who's next on the list?
Yep.
Next up was the former Secretary of the Treasury in the Jefferson and the first part of the Madison administrations, Albert Gallatin. So we're now on candidate number two and a former Treasury Secretary. However, as we saw in his episode, Gallatin was not interested in returning to the post that he had held already for nearly 13 years previously, so he politely declined. So no sigh of relief here. It was like, okay, wish that would have worked out, but whatever. Candidate number three. With Gallatin's refusal, Adams submitted Rush's name to the Senate for confirmation as Treasury Secretary, and he was easily confirmed. To replace Rush in London, Adams initially reached out to DeWitt Clinton, who was a also ran political or presidential candidate. But after his refusal, Adams turned to Rufus King, Federalist from New York, who had previously served as U.S. Minister to Britain under Washington, the elder Adams, and Jefferson. And so it's interesting, you know, you have these names that we've talked about so much still in play, still coming up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a really interesting time because even though we're kind of moving into this new generation, we've still got some of these lingering figures that are around and still playing a role in politics. Now, despite this convoluted path that got him there, Rush arrived in Washington, D.C. in July 1825 and threw himself into his new post. Surprise, surprise, Rush is going to throw himself into whatever role he's in.
I mean, he's totally lazy. I don't know why all of a sudden he decided that this was the post that he was going to throw himself into.
This is the one. Now, the Secretary of the Navy, Samuel Southard, had been serving as acting Treasury Secretary until Rush's arrival, so it was from him that he took command of one of the largest departments of the federal government. As noted by historian Leonard D. White in his book, Jeffersonians, quote, in 1826, the number of clerks and messengers in Treasury headquarters had more than doubled since 1801 to 181, an increase due to the auditing business. Mm-hmm. The number in the Customs Service had increased to 894, and the Internal Revenue Service had been liquidated. The total Treasury staff was 1,075 individuals. So,
wow.
Treasury is growing exponentially. They're reordering and restructuring some things, but it's still just continuing to grow. One of the first tasks that Rush was faced with in this post was floating a loan of $12 million. And so, Rush is like, I've been there. I got it. It's fine. I can do it. Now, all of this would have been a heavy lift for anybody. But as noted by Powell, Rush, quote, found himself handicapped by personnel inadequate and incapable. Most of the lesser officials were political appointees of several years back. So he's inheriting these folks and he's like, you know, kind of past their prime, or maybe they were political appointees from the beginning and just really aren't up to the task. Rush tried to address the issue, but he was hampered by President Adams, who felt, quote, that the civil service of the government should not be disturbed merely because a new president was in office. He refused to make the American government a continuous scramble for office. So you have to imagine Rush was a little frustrated, you know. What do you mean I can't hire my own staff? I don't want these folks. I don't feel they're up to the job, but Adams is going to have his way. Okay. It's not worth it to argue with John Quincy Adams. Of all people, just don't even try.
Yeah. No, you'll lose.
You'll lose. So, despite this, Rush would approach his new position, as described by Powell, quote, as an opportunity to give the most extensive expression to political and economic nationalism. Rush had a view of the economic situation of the United States shaped by his experience in Europe. Again from Powell, Rush's vision was as follows, quote, to replace the mercantile empires, the manufacturers of America would spring up, bringing to the world of the independent new world opulence formerly accruing to European imperial powers. New lands, new routes of trade, new markets would stimulate a new productivity in the United States, creating a new economic, though not a political, empire. So he's saying we've got an opportunity here. If we can build up our domestic manufacturers and start trading with all these new nations, you know, the Western Hemisphere is now full of new nations that have sprung up from the remnants of the Spanish Empire, and in some cases, you know, French colonies and British colonies. He's saying now we've got an opportunity to build an economic empire.
Again, forward thinking, having that quote unquote, I mean, it is a global mindset, but mm-hmm. really, truly, literally and figuratively a global mindset of, hey, this is how our country can grow. Here's how we can, you know, grow our domestic products. Yeah. So it's just it's interesting that in every single position that he comes in, he has kind of the long game in mind and tries to implement that in his position.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is, you know, Rush by this point had become a proponent of what became known as the American system. So we typically talk about this in the context of Henry Clay. And Powell describes this as follows, quote, "The American system, as these leaders developed it, had become a program of political, economic, social, and cultural planning. Its popular following was drawn largely from New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and those parts of the West which benefited from internal improvements, or which, like New Orleans, were bound by the triangular system of internal trade to the manufacturing centers of the East." So this is a larger system. Like you were saying, Alicia, you know, he's really seeing like the end game, this larger scope. And Rush saw, quote, "agriculture as the first pillar in the state, commerce the second, domestic industry, the great intermediate interest, strengthening and upholding both the others." So he's seeing we need the raw materials, we need the commerce, but we also need this middle ground of manufacturing. Now, this is where we get to, you know, we talked about previously, I mentioned that he was really into free trade. We're going to see a bit of a different take from Secretary of the Treasury Rush in a minute. Rush would be part of an administration that worked closely in tandem with the president, and he worked also as well closely with his cabinet colleagues. As described by Powell, quote, "The cabinet ministers called almost daily to report to Adams. Stated meetings occurred once a week." So this is an administration. They are a well-oiled machine and wanting to make sure everybody's on the same page. Meanwhile, as noted by Powell, quote, "Official Washington in 1825 was very different from that Rush had left in 1817. The easygoing informality of Madison's time was gone. Monroe had established an etiquette like that of a European court, which was becoming even more severe and dignified under the precise manners of Adams." Rush would quickly throw himself into the political melee after his return to Washington with the publication of an anonymous pamphlet entitled "The Election of President in the House of Representatives to the People of the United States," in which he defended Adams's election. So it's interesting because this is, you know, this is an awkward political time. You know, it was known that Andrew Jackson had gotten more of the popular vote, but here John Quincy Adams was president. And so there were already rumblings. And so Rush throws himself in. He's like, "We need to get support behind this administration. We need to go ahead and say we are a legitimate administration because we need to get things done."
Right.
Because Rush would use his position as head of the Treasury Department to push an agenda of protectionism and high tariffs in order to help to cultivate domestic manufacturing. Now, this is where we get to, you know, this idea of protectionism versus free trade. So basically, Rush is saying that we need high tariffs to make sure that imported goods are higher in cost than what we're able to make here to help to push people to buy domestic products and help the industry to develop and grow so that we can compete with these already established foreign manufacturers and be able to really develop the domestic scene in terms of manufacture and industry. And so this is kind of, this is changing from his previous views. But Rush does differ from other protectionists at the time because he still supported a policy of shrinking the national debt. Other protectionists were saying, you know what, we don't care, we can grow the debt. It's that good, that that national good that Alexander Hamilton talked about so long ago, that this was something to the benefit of the nation to have a larger national debt. But Rush is saying, no, we still need to shrink that debt while we're growing our domestic manufacture. And so Powell notes that, quote, Rush had become the official representative of the protectionists, their spearhead of policy, their mirror in the government. And so a year into his new role, Rush undertook two major projects in the summer of 1826. The first was directly related to his work at Treasury. Quote, collectors had to be removed or appointed, their records scrutinized, some of them reprimanded, frauds upon the revenue had been discovered and required exhaustive investigation. Banking facilities were needed in the new Western states. All had to be done with an eye to the fall election. So he's saying we need to clean house, we need to get our affairs in order so that we can go into these elections and say we are the good government people. We are the stewards of good government. The other was a more personal matter. Partnered with Secretary of War James Barber of Virginia, Rush led an effort to, quote, solicit subscriptions for a fund to relieve the poverty of Thomas Jefferson. So this was the time towards the end of Jefferson's life. His finances are a complete disaster, a complete wreck. And word's starting to get out that Jefferson is heavily in debt. And so Rush becomes part of that effort to try and provide relief. But as we know, on July 4th, 1826, Jefferson passed away. On that same day, Rush and Secretary of War James Barber led, quote, a procession of all the officials of the administration from the president's mansion to the U.S. Capitol, where, quote, in the hall of the House of Representatives, speeches and prayers commemorated the 50th anniversary of the nation, after which Barber and then Rush delivered addresses relating the need in which Jefferson lived and urged the assemblage to make up the relief fund. So it's interesting. You've got this huge 4th of July celebration and they're incorporating this, you know, let's relieve the suffering of our former president, founding father. And little did they know that at 1 p.m., Jefferson had passed away. Rush struggled to keep above the growing political battle in Washington between supporters of Adams and Clay and supporters of Andrew Jackson and Vice President John C. Calhoun. This political scene is becoming ever more contentious, you know, and it's thinking of 1828. Now, it did help that he had work to do on the president's second annual report that fall, and naturally, Rush used the opportunity to continue the push for protectionism. Though, as Rush wrote to a friend, quote, that I had not the least support from a single human being in Congress is true, but I am not the less confident that I am right. So he's starting to see, you know, he's starting to see where the political winds are blowing. He knows he's not going in that direction, but he's still saying this is the right thing to do.
Well, and he had lots of practice, right? He had to go against his father at a very young age. And so I think that helped him and made him more strength in his convictions, or more confident, I should say, in his convictions. So also something you want in a cabinet secretary is somebody in your administration, right? You want somebody who's not necessarily just going to be your yes man. It's going to be the guy that says, hey, we got to do it this way. It might be painful, but this is my recommendation, and I'm not just going to go with the flow just to make people happy. So
exactly. And so this is very much Rush. This is what he's doing.
Yeah.
And at this point, opposition to protectionism was settling in with Southern leaders, as well as with commercial interests in New England, who would not benefit from a high tariff. So you've got these really two competing interests. You have folks who will benefit from it, and you've got folks who realize this will hurt their business or their interests. And indeed, it would be through the tie-breaking vote of Vice President John C. Calhoun that the Mallory Tariff Bill, which was very much aligned with the recommendations of Treasury Secretary Rush, was voted down in the Senate in January 1827. Rush's continued strong push for protectionism as a key part of the American system, as well as his continued involvement in the American Colonization Society, did not win him any supporters in the South. As you can imagine. So, though the political will for change may not have been there, Rush was determined to do what he could to affect progress in his leadership at the Treasury Department. As noted by Powell, quote, Rush instituted a better method of accounting with customs records so that in a few years, exact information regarding both home industry and foreign trade might be available. He also continued to push for the American system principles, including protectionism, in his third annual report to Congress in 1827. Powell describes this report as, quote, in many ways, the best statement of the policies of the American nationalist of the 1820s that anyone produced. However, it was delivered to a Congress in which, for the first time since the ratification of the Constitution, the pro-administration faction was in the minority in both houses of Congress. So this is going to a very hostile Congress. And thus, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee in the House, in his answer to Rush's report, quote, questioned the constitutional authority of the secretary to make recommendations in his report of the nature he had, and instead pushed free trade policies in opposition to Rush's protectionist proposals.
Well, as a cabinet secretary, he's supposed to give you the lay of the land and to give you what's going on in his department and to make recommendations to make his department more efficient and effective. So that's an interesting take. I know that things were very tense in that time period, but that's an interesting argument that he made.
Politicians making outrageous arguments. Never happened before or since.
No.
Of course, with the election year of 1828, Rush would find himself caught in the crossfire of political maneuverings because the pro-Jackson faction in Congress came up with a scheme to turn New England, New York, and Pennsylvania against President Adams by putting forward a high tariff bill, which really wasn't to anyone's benefit, but in its defeat at the hands of Adams' supporters, would turn those key states against the administration just in time to benefit Andrew Jackson's presidential campaign in that election year. So they were basically saying, you know, these are really states that are pro-tariff, and if we have the Adams administration and their supporters pushing against a tariff bill, we can use that in the election. This scheme, however, went off the rails. And to everyone's surprise, the bill that came to be known as the Tariff of Abominations passed. Now, though Rush was opposed to the tariff bill because he looked at it and he was like, oh my gosh, what Frankenstein monster have you created? As Adams had signed it into law, the Treasury Secretary was called on to defend it. So, not a good position to be in. Rush also had to answer a scathing report from a select committee on retrenchment and reform, which criticized his administration of the Treasury Department. While the report attacked the growth of the size of government and increasing government expenditures, Rush used the opportunity to argue that this was due to the increasing work of the government to meet the needs of a growing nation, and asserted that more clerks were needed in the Treasury to keep up with their workload. Hey, you keep on adding new territories and new lands, we're going to need more people to support this.
Yep. I mean, that sounds like a valid argument.
You would think. Rush would take up his pen in 1828, not just for his own defense, but for that of the Adams administration. First came his pamphlet, Sketch of the Character of Mr. Canning, on the occasion of the death of George Canning, who by that point had briefly risen from the post of British Foreign Secretary to become prime minister prior to his demise. Now, though this was supposed to be about George Canning, Rush would use the opportunity to defend the administration and its efforts at negotiating with Canning, which were stymied by, quote, the personal antagonism of Canning. So he's writing this thing and saying, you know what? We did what we could. George Canning was just not somebody that you could negotiate with. I can speak from personal experience. He also turned out a series of anonymous articles to be published in newspapers on behalf of the administration. However, as the year went on, it was increasingly becoming clear that this was a fruitless exercise. Thus, Rush approached President Adams about the possibility of leaving the cabinet to resume his role as U.S. Minister to Britain. Adams, however, intended that role to go to his Secretary of War, James Barber, Thus, Rush continued to labor on behalf of the administration. But back in Pennsylvania, at a caucus meeting in Harrisburg, Rush's name was put forward as a vice presidential candidate after the caucus endorsed Adams's renomination. So at this point, you know, the vice president was John C. Calhoun, and there was no way an Adams supporter was going to put forward John C. Calhoun as his running mate. And so Rush, here you've got somebody who's been very loyal to this administration, as well as the previous ones. Maybe this is our guy. So Rush did accept this nomination, though he was doubtful of his chances of ever assuming office as vice president. Still, praise did come in for Rush, including the statement from a pro-administration convention in Concord, New Hampshire, endorsing his vice presidential nomination. Quote, "He is descended from one of the purest revolutionary patriots. He is conspicuous for his talents and distinguished for his virtues and industry. He has had long and varied experience in high and important posts and is, in every respect, well qualified for any station to which the votes of his fellow citizens or fellow events may raise him." On the one hand, he's starting to get all this praise. But also being the vice presidential nominee, he was, of course, going to come in for criticism. From the House of Representatives, he was publicly ridiculed by Representative John Randolph of Roanoke, Democratic Republican from Virginia, who we have encountered quite a few times on the podcast. And on July 26th, a letter from Rush using the pseudonym of Julius appeared in the National Journal, ripping into Randolph, and not just on the point of Randolph's politics. Rush went so far as to ridicule Randolph's appearance and demeanor and exclaimed, quote, "What a ridiculous charlatan I am describing." So, how? Yeah. He is.
That's a decision, I guess.
That's a decision. And Powell asserts that, quote, "It is unique among Rush's writings, for never before or afterwards did he indulge so in personalities. It was angry, vitriolic, acidulous, and cruel." So,
yeah,
you know, this is, you know, he's not taking the high road with this one. He's going for the jugular. He's saying, you know, this guy is ridiculous looking. Look at his stupid face, you know. And, oh, by the way, have you heard him speak? It's ridiculous. You know, it's, you're getting the sense that Rush is just really frustrated on so many levels.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I wonder if it's not, yeah, it's just not the kind of the residual impact of a very long campaign and having been in Adams' administration. I'm sure was no easy task, considering I know how unpopular he was throughout his tenure. So I wonder if that just wasn't his lashing out just to defend himself and his honor the best way he knew how at that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And ultimately, you know, after this raucous and contentious campaign, the administration's ticket lost the election. So Jackson and his running mate, who was the sitting vice president, John C. Calhoun, who we're, of course, going to talk much more about as we go along, they won the election. Jackson won just over 647,000 votes versus President Adams's 508,000 votes. In the Electoral College, Adams and Rush only secured 83 electoral votes, which were from 8 northern states, as well as Delaware and Maryland. And what you can imagine was probably a low blow, Rush's home state of Pennsylvania went to Jackson and Calhoun. Rush wrote of the defeat afterwards that, quote, "Individually, I never permitted myself to form hopes. I shall therefore not be disappointed. There is evidence enough here that my candidateship was not of my own seeking, but the contrary. Not but that I was heartily willing that my name should be used, if it were thought that it could do the least good, but I never thought it would." And so he's saying, I really didn't want this. Of course, I'm a good trooper. I'm willing to do what needs to be done, but I really didn't want this to begin with. So I'm not really disappointed. I'm really not. Don't ask me any more questions. I don't want to talk about it. Also, you know, this is just, beyond just the campaign, his 4 years in office, having to deal with an increasingly hostile Congress, you have to imagine that in some ways it was a bittersweet defeat, but it was also kind of like, I don't have to deal with this anymore.
Yeah.
And so he worked to wrap up his business. He proved to be the only member of the cabinet to recommend to Adams that he attend Jackson's inauguration.
Mm.
And as we know, this advice was not actually acted upon. Adams left D.C. and did not attend the inauguration. On March 3rd, after dinner, Rush met with Adams in his new lodgings on Meridian Hill in Washington and tendered his resignation as Secretary of the Treasury. When his brother James asked Rush to approach the new president about a government position that he was interested in, Richard wrote back to his brother that, quote, General Jackson has taken away my office, and I am left with a wife and seven children without a farthing of income, and with but contingent prospects of earning one. I have no complaint against him for this, as no citizen has any claim of right upon the tenure of office. But I must decline becoming even the remote messenger or medium of passing to his hand a letter that looks eventually to an official favor at them.
Mm-hmm.
So even though, and it does seem just like with the election, you doth protest too much. You know, I'm not really bitter, but I'm not asking a favor of that man.
Right.
Now, Powell sums up the second cabinet tenure as follows, quote, technically, Rush was an able steward of the Treasury. This, combined with the prosperity of the 4 years of his tenure, produced an accounting that truly was a credit to the administration. The nation was in an opulent financial condition. It was at peace. Its fiscal structure was sound. Jackson inherited the results of successful service. Moreover, Rush had expanded the scope of the department by the establishment of branch banks in the New West, improvement of the revenue service on the Great Lakes, and in many other ways. He has adequate cause to be satisfied with his record. But, of course, as he himself stated, when he left office, his financial situation was in rather of a mess. He did not have the income to maintain his home in Washington, and though Rush had property in Philadelphia, the high cost of living in that city made a return there not a viable prospect. Thus, since he had some property in York, Pennsylvania, and the surrounding county, Richard moved Catherine and the five of his children still at home there. The house in Washington was rented out while Rush sold his properties in Philadelphia. Meanwhile, he found himself a temporary gig involving some travel, because in 1829, Rush traveled abroad as an agent for the cities of Alexandria and Georgetown in order, quote, to negotiate a loan in London for building a canal between the Chesapeake Bay and the Ohio River. So they were like, well, this guy's been in Treasury for a bit. He knows how to negotiate a loan. He knows folks in London. Here's our guy. So he departed from New York at the end of April and made his way to London. Despite staying in the city for 8 weeks and drawing on his large list of contacts in the financial industry he had made during his years there, Rush was unable to find anyone interested in providing the needed capital. He did, however, get a recommendation to try his luck in the Netherlands. So he traveled there in July, stayed for 2 months. No luck there. So back to London he goes. But he gets word that some of the bankers that he had met with in Holland had reconsidered and were ready to invest. And thus, on November 20th, he signed an agreement with a banking house out of Amsterdam for a loan of 3,750,000 French francs to the canal corporation Rush was representing. So he actually made it happen. Took a bit, took some work, but he got the loan. Unfortunately, upon his return, the corporation refused to pay him in full for his services, and he would not be fully compensated for this near year's worth of work in his lifetime.
What a bummer.
Yeah. He's like, I got you all of that money for your stupid canal after
that. You asked me to go do this. I didn't say, hey, I'm so excited to go overseas again with my financial situation. I did this because we had what I thought was an agreement, and now you're not going to pay me? Wow.
And after that awful man took my job that I'm not bitter about. And now this, I've wasted a year on this. Yeah. His return to the U.S. would see Rush undertake another series of public letters using the pseudonym Temple, outlining his observations while in London about the recent change in government in Britain. Politically, in his own nation, and particularly returning home to Pennsylvania, Rush found himself isolated. Thanks to the work of state leaders like James Buchanan in the election of 1828, Pennsylvania had swung hard for Jackson, and so Rush and other proponents of the American system were largely on the outside looking in. You know, they were out of power, out of favor. In April 1831, Rush would be called upon in a public letter written by a group of his fellow residents in York to express publicly his opinions on the Masonic Order as part of a wave of anti-Mason sentiment that had come into Pennsylvania from New York. Rush came out against the Masons, remarking that, quote, pursuing objects not known to the public, through means not known to the public, they act under diminished responsibilities to the public, and asserting that in the U.S., quote, primary principles of politician and social action are all carried out in the face of day. And so he's saying, you know, here we have these secret societies that are influencing public affairs. This isn't right.
Yeah.
This new movement would start to gain popularity, and Rush, as well as other national Republicans, as the former Adams supporters were coming to be known as, saw this as a means to organize an opposition to Jackson and his supporters. Rush would become a leader of the anti-Masonic movement in York, and through his writing, made York, quote, one of the centers of agitation. So he was starting to come back into political prominence, starting to build up a new organization. However, as Clay's control over the National Republicans became more pronounced, and President Jackson started to launch his attack on the Bank of the United States, rather than falling into line behind Clay, Rush found himself increasingly in agreement with Jackson's arguments.
Huh.
That awful man is not so awful anymore.
Interesting.
Because Rush, from his perspective from Pennsylvania, he felt that, quote, the bank had hampered the commercial interest by its policies in relation to the state banks. So he's like, the bank is, you know, we've got these state banks that are starting to help things to prosper, you know, banking, the banking industry is starting to grow, but the National Bank is hindering that, and in turn is hindering commerce. And thus, in this crucial 1832 election, Rush, true to form, because he's always using these presidential elections to shake things up, he makes his break with the National Republicans in a big way. In this election, National Republicans and anti-Masons were starting to think, hey, maybe if we band together, we can take on Jackson and the Democrats. But just before the state elections, Rush released a letter critical of Clay and the National Republicans, which caused anti-Masons in York to, quote, refuse to vote at all, or, in the moment of indignation, threw their votes for Jackson. He is decimating their chances at winning in the state in favor of Jackson. As you can imagine, the National Republicans were none too pleased. They saw this as him undermining Clay's candidacy for the presidency. And meanwhile, state anti-Masons are like, dude, what are you doing? We had the gubernatorial candidate. We had the National Republicans were in line to vote for our candidate. We might have won this. You screwed this up majorly.
Right.
And indeed, Clay and the anti-Masonic candidate for governor in Pennsylvania would go down in defeat that year. And the thing was, you know, Clay's election, pretty much it was guaranteed it was going to go to Jackson.
Right.
The gubernatorial race, on the other hand, was close. And so it is very possible that it was because of Richard Rush that the anti-Masonic candidate went down. Yeah. Now, interestingly enough, before this article came out, Rush was being talked about in the state legislature as a candidate for the U.S. Senate. After that article was published, the anti-Masons.
Those discussions stopped.
No, nope. And so the Democratic candidate was elected. The hits kept on coming because Rush's membership in the American Philosophical Society was revoked by its board because of this letter and his going hard for Jackson.
Hmm.
Again, on the outside, you know, here we are again. He's finding himself isolated. And at this point, Rush had only one direction to go. So Richard Rush, champion of protectionism and the American system, became a Democrat.
Well, that's a change.
This is very much a change. And he actually tried to get other anti-Masons to join him in this, despite the fact that the leader of the Democratic Party was the Mason, Andrew Jackson. So naturally, this new attempt at influencing the political scene in Pennsylvania didn't work out so well. As the 1835 gubernatorial election neared, Rush threw his hat in with Democratic candidate Henry Muhlenberg and worked to persuade German anti-Masons over to the Muhlenberg camp. Unfortunately, the Democratic side was split between Muhlenberg and another candidate, and so the National Republicans and anti-Masons, without Rush involved in their affairs, were actually able to come together and push their candidate to victory. Nationwide, as the 1830s went on, this partnership between the National Republicans and anti-Masons would ultimately coalesce into what became the Whig Party. In terms of his political ideology and intellectual development, as described by Powell, quote, Rush experienced a sort of revival of his principles. In his writing in these years, he turned more often than ever before to the fundamental problems of political relationships. He reread some of the great Renaissance and 18th century classics of politics, infusing something of their spirit into his work. He also began starting in 1833 to publish the journals that he kept during his time as U.S. Minister to Britain. So he's starting to do this rethink and starting to have kind of this reflection and resurgence of his political thoughts and his intellectual journey. Personally, he found himself out of step with the local leaders in York after breaking his ties with the National Republicans and anti-Masons, so he decided to move his family to a farm just outside of Philadelphia. As described by Powell, quote, here in a handsome little cottage, a century old, he built up a small estate, combining farming with a modest law practice that access to the city made possible. So from this position, you know, he's like, things aren't working out in York. Let me get closer to Philadelphia because I can start to revive my law practice there. And also, I can start to invite some leading Democratic leaders in Philadelphia. Let's come and talk. Come and join me on my country estate. And indeed, it did, quote, become a familiar rendezvous for the leading members of the Democratic Party in Philadelphia. Rush was once more in the political swing of things, and he would start to see some political benefits. In 1835, he was appointed as a commissioner, quote, to settle a boundary controversy between Ohio and Michigan. And in the next year, President Jackson appointed Rush to travel back to Britain, quote, to secure the estate of James Smithson, which he brought back as the nucleus of the Smithsonian Institution.
Mm.
Now, this position brought with it a good salary and an expense fund. And so this was a golden opportunity for him to start to rebuild his personal finances, but then also establishing this legacy of what would become the Smithsonian. So he was able to set sail on August 31st, 1836. The process would not be an easy one because the Court of Chancery that the estate had to be processed through was backed up with over 800 cases when Rush filed a suit. And so he ended up staying for quite a while. Fall gave way to winter, which gave way to spring, which gave way to summer, back in fall, and he was still in London. But of course, this wasn't a bad place to be stuck in. If you're going to be stuck somewhere, London's a pretty good place. And especially when you've got you've got contacts within the aristocracy, within the intellectual circles, the scholars, you know, so he would use this as an opportunity. He also took advantage of the situation for the public good and wrote back to the Secretary of War and the incoming Van Buren administration about his, quote, careful accounts of what he saw, urging effective defense armament in America in the midst of disputes along the U.S.-Canadian border at the time. So he was able to speak to what he was hearing about on the British side in their preparations just in case things went to war. As Rush described to the Secretary of War, quote, we live in an age in which the world is moving forward, and we are not the nation to lag behind. On the contrary, it is a paramount advantage we have. It is, in fact, an element of power with us that, having existing establishments that fetter us less and minds more ready for new investigations than is generally seen in older nations, we adopt improvements sooner and more effectually. So he's saying, you know, we are well positioned to become global leaders. We've got to take advantage of what we've got, the opportunities that we have.
Yeah.
And indeed, this was a changing world because Rush would be in London when Queen Victoria came to the throne.
Mm.
He is there for the beginning of the Victorian era.
Wow.
Finally, at the beginning of 1838, so he's been there, this is going on his second year, Rush decided the time had come to make concessions in the business of the Smithson estate. And finally, on May 9th, quote, Chancellor Lyndhurst solemnly pronounced the decree adjudging the Smithson bequest to the United States. And so finally, the 57-year-old Rush was able to wrap up his business in London. Once the bequest was awarded, Rush found that he had to process the 3% annuities that made up the bulk of the estate, awarded as, quote, he decided to convert it into gold and bring it home as bullion. So he's like, let's just go ahead and cash out the annuities. I want gold.
Yeah.
That he's going to travel with. So naturally, he gets insurance on his cargo because when you're hauling literal gold, it's like that.
Yep.
And so with every arrangement made, Rush boarded a packet ship in late July to make his way home. He arrived in New York on August 28th, then traveled to Philadelphia, where he deposited the gold with the treasurer and, quote, on September 15th, rendered a full account of his expenses to Washington. So, actually managed to get the gold in, didn't lose any, we're all good. But as noted by Powell, quote, of all his public services, the founding of the Smithsonian Institution was the one in which Rush took the most pride. It was an accomplishment that seemed to fulfill all those cultural ambitions of the enlarged nationalism he had embraced.
Well, it seemed right up his wheelhouse, too, right? Like a guy who was dedicated to learning, dedicated to literature, to science, to kind of always investigating new ideas, kind of being involved in something like that is totally up his wheelhouse.
Absolutely. And he didn't stop with just securing the money, because he sent a letter to Secretary of State John Forsyth with his proposals on how it should be allocated. And, quote, Rush's letter contains so many proposals that were later adopted that it may properly be called the blueprint of the institution as it eventually developed.
Mm, that's a nice legacy.
It is. It is. And he wasn't done yet. However, his return to the United States would not find him in any better of a financial position personally. And in 1842, he had to apply to Congress for a balance of £750, which had been part of his expenses package in his most recent mission to London. And this money was ultimately awarded to Rush as a bonus on top of his agreed upon salary. So he's still struggling personally financially, but he continued to write on behalf of Democratic candidates for president and for offices in Philadelphia. Though, of course, he was disappointed in 1840, which went the Whigs' way, the next presidential election would bring another Democrat to the White House in the form of James K. Polk, which would bring opportunities for Rush. In 1845, in the midst of new challenges in Anglo-American relations, Rush arranged for the publication of his second volume of his journals from his tenure as U.S. Minister to Britain in order to add to the public discourse on the subject. It was published nearly simultaneously in the U.S. and Britain, with the first American copy going to President Polk, while the first British copy went to Queen Victoria. It was a tremendous success and was very well received, with Rush receiving letters of congratulations from former President John Quincy Adams, as well as former First Lady Dolly Madison.
Did these journals help him in his finances? Because I know that was something that the Madisons, I believe, did to try to help Dolly stay out of poverty. So I imagine, obviously, yes, to add to the public discourse, but also he needed money. So did that help him in his finances at all?
It did somewhat, and it also contributed to his next step, because he's not done with public service just yet. Yep. So first of all, he would find himself engaged in informal diplomatic talks when, in February 1846, Lord Ashburton sent a letter to Rush, quote, proposing his, i.e. Rush's, services as mediator in the conflict between the U.S. and Britain over the Oregon Territory. And so getting the go-ahead from the Polk administration, he did engage with Ashburton in letters back and forth. Their work gave Ashburton his talking points with the government of British Prime Minister Robert Peel, and the British came to the negotiating table with a new treaty being signed on June 15th, dividing the territory between the two nations. So he is still heavily involved with diplomacy. Meanwhile, the Polk administration in 1846 would finally take action on the Smithson bequest, and Rush was named as one of the first regents of the Smithsonian Institution. He went to the first meeting of the Smithsonian Institution Board of Regents, and while there, he met with President Polk and his cabinet to determine a proper site for the institution's headquarters in Washington. He would be present the next May when Vice President George Dallas laid the cornerstone for the Smithsonian in a Masonic ceremony. This anti-Mason, present for a Masonic ceremony. Whatever. Whatever. And honestly, by that point, Rush was already preparing to go back to Europe, because President Polk had originally appointed Charles J. Ingersoll as the new U.S. Minister to France in late 1846, but the Senate refused to confirm him, and realizing that he needed to get a trusted diplomat in that important post sooner rather than later, and given all of his involvement with foreign affairs to that point, Polk nominated Rush as Minister to France at the beginning of March 1847. The Senate immediately confirmed him, and by March 3rd, his commission was on his way. Though Rush was initially reluctant due to Ingersoll's anger at being blocked by the Senate, finally, Ingersoll gave his blessing, Secretary Buchanan urged him, and Rush agreed to take up the post. Unfortunately, this time his wife Catherine proved too ill to accompany him, so the 66-year-old Rush departed alone across the Atlantic. But the France that Rush arrived in mid-July was a troubled one. Again from Powell, the King, quote, Louis-Philippe was 74 years old in 1847, in the 17th year of his troubled reign. Rarely was a government more reviled or a king more disliked. Most Frenchmen found the king, if not sinister, at least boring.
The Orléans monarchy
had known scarcely a day of peace or security since it began. Opposed by legitimists, Bonapartists, Republican reformists, socialists, attacked by a host of left-wing doctrinaires, Louis-Philippe represented not a united nation, but only one social class within it. In 1847, this class, the bourgeois, was split between conservatives and reformists, so that even what support the king could command was ineffectual. This was a very divided nation and a volatile nation that Rush was arriving in. And he tried to make sense of this discontent. And Rush was trying it was too much for him to process, because he saw a nation technically on paper was doing well. France was a prosperous nation, but it was just divided politically and socially. Despite Rush's good relations with Louis-Philippe's ministry, the state of affairs in France and the unpopularity of its government meant that little progress could be made. And thus, by fall, Rush was already, quote, bored with Paris, bored with his mission, exasperated with the government. Again from Powell, quote, though the court was attended by the greatest minds of France, The atmosphere was one of conventionality and repose. Paris was neither intellectually exciting, nor beautiful, nor politically important. It was only expensive. So Rush is already, he's like, I'm really just not excited here, and things seem to be going in a bad direction. He stays, but then things get heated. Everything changes the night of February 22nd, 1848. Rush went to bed that evening, none the wiser, and woke up, quote, the next morning in the midst of civil war. As Rush wrote at the time, quote, the belief seems to be that a complete revolution has been effected, the people having the upper hand everywhere, and none of the troops or National Guards any longer acting against them. They are in possession of the Tuileries, made a bonfire of the king's carriages, the king, queen, and royal family escaping through the gardens. I go to the Quai d'Orsay in front of my house, see the people looking out of the palace windows, see them throwing furniture out of the windows, see them pass by the place where I stood. They shout out with guns and sabers in their hands. All is wild disorganization. Richard Rush is in the midst of the French Revolution of 1848.
He is a witness to some monumental moments in history.
Yes. As I kept reading and learning more about him, it's like, oh my gosh, what wasn't he involved in?
Really? Seriously?
And so by the evening of the 25th, the French monarchy was gone and a provisional Republican government was in place. Beyond just being concerned for his own safety, because, I mean, Paris is at arms, things are burning. It's chaos. Yeah. Rush was also in a precarious position in the midst of this revolution because the provisional government technically did not have official diplomatic standing. So Rush had to consider whether he was authorized to engage with this new government. Now, given that it would take time to receive an official response from Washington to let them know what was going on and see what the administration wanted to do, Rush knew that he would have to make the call on his own and deal with the consequences. Now, there were certainly arguments to be made that it was within the interest of the United States to recognize this de facto government, especially considering that the U.S. had recognized so many South American governments when they had declared independence. But there's still this, you know, is this really, what is this government? Is this something that we can recognize? But finally, Rush decided, quote, that as soon as he had official notification of the existence of the provisional government and of Lamartine as its foreign minister, he would recognize the Republic. Now, the British ambassador tried to convince him otherwise. It was like, just hold off. It's like, let's wait to hear back from our governments. And he was like, well, you know, your government is right across the channel. Mine is across the ocean. I don't have time to wait. Meanwhile, he consulted with Latin American ambassadors in London, and they decided to follow Rush's lead. And thus, on Monday, February 28th, quote, Rush donned his diplomatic dress, took the legation secretary with him to the Hôtel de Ville, where he was at once conducted to the provisional government. In a brief address, he presumed to offer the congratulations of the American people to the new regime, mentioning the ancient friendship of the two nations, their mutual adventure in republicanism, and hope that the friendship of the two republics might be commiserate with their existence. And so naturally, there is this outpouring of excitement. Les États-Unis are recognizing the French Republic. In his report to Secretary of State Buchanan, Rush concluded that, quote, I must humbly hope that my course will be approved by the president, yourself, and the cabinet. So he had to send this off and wait to see, is Polk going to be happy about this or not? But in the meantime, he had to deal with the business of the embassy. And so he was dealing with all of this stuff, you know, and also he was getting French officials and French citizens who were coming to him asking, well, what does it mean to be a republic?
Right.
He even engaged in discussions of political science and theory with Alexis de Tocqueville. And so U.S. Minister to Britain, George Bancroft, came over from London, and they joined in the discussions with de Tocqueville about the possibilities for this new French Republic. So this is kind of akin to Thomas Jefferson at the beginning of the first French Revolution. You've got the French coming to him and saying, well, what kind of government can we form? What should we do here? But ultimately, the turmoil of revolution was not at an end. And after the new National Assembly assembled in early May, by the 15th, quote, a mob stormed the assembly, drove them out of the chamber, and proclaimed a new regime. Though this revolt was quickly shut down, Rush, as well as other observers, had every reason to wonder about the stability of this new republic. By late June, the city of Paris was in arms once more, and as described by Powell, quote, indecision, disunity, and lack of imagination were causing the republic to fall apart, and it was apparent to all, including Rush, that Louis Napoleon could use the situation to rise to power, and by December, Louis Napoleon had won election as president of the republic. So this is a big disappointment for Rush. You know, he's seeing this opportunity to be part of a new burgeoning republic, and he knows it's about to go the way of the Napoleonic Empire again. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, of course, he's still suffering from personal finances. He's still suffering from being in debt. And finally, he just says, you know what? I'm kind of done. I'm getting to the point I just want to leave. 1848 was a presidential election year. Perfect opportunity for Rush to make a change. Zachary Taylor won the election. And Rush was, you know, he was starting to get eager to go home, but he was also like, well, they may want to keep me on for a little bit. You know, typically folks serve in these posts 3 years at this point. But after Taylor took office, his replacement had already been decided upon. But to add insult to injury, once he learned this, it would take months for official word to go to the French government. So Rush was just stuck knowing that he was out of a job, but not able to leave. Finally, in October, with his successor arrived and presented to the French government, Richard Rush made his way to Le Havre to board a ship which would bring him back home after an eventful 27 months abroad. And this would be his last trip abroad. As noted by Powell, quote, Rush went into retirement quietly. It was an anticlimax. His son Ben suggested that he appeal to the people when he returned, for election to the Senate would be the perfect justification. Rush emphatically refused, because he came home and he found that his wife Catherine's situation, her condition had severely deteriorated in his absence. And so, quote, he devoted many hours of each day to her, the rest of his time to correspondence on public affairs. He had come back to a nation that was being torn apart by the slavery debate, and Rush, in his part, urged folks to turn to the cause of union above all else. Again from Powell, quote, Rush's position was bound to be ignored between extremes of both sides. It was shared by his friend Buchanan and reached its culmination in that statesman's nomination for the presidency in 1856. Because Rush was a supporter of the Compromise of 1850, he thought, let's really focus on keeping the Union together. And those details, you know, we can compromise, we can figure things out. But as we know, the Compromise of 1850 was pretty shameful in some respects. In his last publication on the subject of foreign relations, quote, Rush advanced far ahead of most of his generation and advocated for an alliance with Great Britain, now that the United States was much more advanced as a nation and could truly be, in his estimation, an equal partner with Britain. As Rush wrote, quote, we are part and parcel of Christendom, and it is no longer possible that a great nation like this can be wholly detached from its movements, lest we should get into entangling alliances. This was a wise rule when we would have been the weaker part, perfectly wise. Amidst the agitations of the present and uncertainties of the future in Europe, where else can we so well look as to England for national characteristics intermediate between arbitrary systems of government on the one side and communism or socialism seeking to ally itself with power on the other. So he's saying, you know, we're at a point, we're an equal to Britain, and we want stability. We don't want this socialism that's, you know, wreaking havoc with these revolutions. We want stability. We need to align with Britain. But by this point, it was just all theory. He was no longer in the place to have a role in foreign relations. And thus, he worked on organizing his papers for posterity. Mm-hmm. At this point, of the 11 children Richard and Catherine had had, only 5 had survived. Meanwhile, his wife Catherine passed away on March 24th, 1854. We don't know her birth date, so she was either age 70 or 71. Rush would live on for a few more years, but at the age of 78, passed away on July 30th, 1859, at his brother's home in Philadelphia, and he would be buried with his wife at Laurel Hill Cemetery. I can't think of a better way to conclude the summation of his career than with this description of Rush from historian Julian P. Boyd. Quote, he was not a political leader seeking the approval of the people, but a holder of offices granted to him by other leaders because of his virtue, talent, and sense of public duty. In personal character, an aristocrat, in political belief, a democrat, he was, in his own person, a symbol of the great contradictions in political thought which stirred the nation during the span of his long and useful life.
Hello, my name is Peter Zablocki, and I'm a historian, author, and college professor. I'm thrilled to invite you to check out Evergreen Network's History Shorts podcast. Every Tuesday and Thursday, join me on a journey through time, exploring the little-known and hidden gems of history. In each bite-sized episode, I'll dive into my original research to bring you intriguing historical curiosities you've probably never heard of, uncovering the fascinating stories that have shaped our world, from forgotten figures to overlooked events. And the best part? I've condensed all this historical goodness into manageable chunks, perfect for your on-the-go lifestyle. Whether you're commuting to work or squeezing in a quick break, History Shorts fits into the little time you probably think you don't have. Subscribe now and never miss an episode of the History Shorts podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, in terms of legacy with his lineage, there are a couple of points spring up. His son, Richard Henry Rush, after graduating from West Point in 1846, served in the Mexican-American War, then was commissioned as a colonel in the Civil War, leading the 6th Pennsylvania Volunteer Cavalry, which was the only cavalry unit in the war to be issued European-style lances, which is why the unit came to be known as Rush's Lancers. These lances, by the way, were never involved in actual combat, but gave him a catchy name. This unit was involved in the Fredericksburg, Chancellorsville, and Gettysburg campaigns and distinguished themselves at the Battle of Brandy Station, Virginia, on June 9, 1863. Richard Henry Rush passed away in 1893 at the age of 68 and is buried at Laurel Hill with his parents and other family members. Richard Henry's older sister, Sarah Catherine, who was born in 1823, would go on to live to age 82, passing away in 1905, the only of the siblings to survive into the 20th century. In terms of his physical legacy, I could not find anything named after Richard Rush. A few things were named in honor of his father, but not Richard. And so if anyone has any evidence to the contrary, please feel free to reach out to Presidencies at presidenciespodcast@gmail.com. But as far as we know, it was just the children that kept his legacy going. And that is the long and interesting twist and turn career and life of Richard Rush.
That was a lot.
It was so funny. Like, while doing the research for this, it was just like he just kept going and going and going.
Yes.
And every presidential election found him with a new job.
Yeah, he's the Energizer Bunny of politics. Jeez.
And so let's just go ahead and launch into our first category, the whole picture. This round looks at the overall career and character of the cabinet member, And Alicia, we can each award up to 10 points maximum. So what are your thoughts on his overall career?
Well, obviously, he was a lifelong diplomat, a public servant, and served various administrations in various capacities. I think in terms of just as a cabinet secretary, we're going to debate that a little bit, I think, later on. But overall, I think you can't have asked for a harder worker dedicated to the institutions of federal government, from being a founding member of the Smithsonian to collecting all the federal laws as attorney general, always seeming to be in the right place at the right time, but also having kind of a big forward vision. I feel like, you know, he's not maybe a Alexander Hamilton in terms of like legacy, but he did a lot considering. So I'm going to go ahead and give him a 7.
Agreed. And I think I'm going to go with an 8, just because, you know, did he get to the top office? No. Did he establish like a really, well, and in some ways it's, he did establish a long-lasting legacy. It's just that nobody really knows that he did it. You know, the Smithsonian right. Institute, you know, he was involved with that. With treaties that lasted for over 100 years, with major treaties with Britain, with right. so much, and being relevant and serving under so many presidents, and even when he wasn't serving under a president, still having their ear and guiding foreign relations and policy, and especially like just this up and down in his fortunes. You know, this is something that mm-hmm. we really haven't seen before. Usually when folks fall, that's it. They're down.
Right.
They're not coming back. And Richard Rush came back. And so, you know, no, it's not the A-list, the, you know, first tier, but he's pretty high up here in terms of a monumental career. So, you know, he gets high marks in this category. So
yep.
with an 8 and a 7, we are at 15 points. So strong start for Richard Rush. But now we have to narrow in into our go-get around to look at his impact during his time in the cabinet as a cabinet member. And so just like the last round, we can both award up to 10 points.
Yeah. And again, I want to give him, you know, high marks, because I do feel like he worked. He wasn't messing around. He was, you know, he was a loyalist to the administration. He didn't undercut the administration like some other people that served. you know, he was judicious. He was effective. And maybe he didn't have, you know, as long of a legacy, quote unquote, or a tangible legacy like other cabinet secretaries. I still feel like he made his mark. I'm still coming back to the collection and the indexing of all the federal laws. Like, that is super helpful. And thinking of just how he really grew the Treasury Department and made it effective, right? Not only is he making this thing a bigger bureaucracy, but he's making it still good accounting and making sure that their books are in order and helping the country kind of stay within budget a little bit. So I think, again, I want to go with a 7. I'm vacillating between a 7 and an 8. So for now, I will say 7, but I reserve the right to change it to an 8, depending on what you say.
Right is reserved. So, and this is such a fascinating study here. This is such a fascinating case here because, you know, first of all, we have somebody who served not only in two different, very different cabinet posts,
right,
different administrations, and came back to the cabinet. You know, he ended his cabinet tenure, went off, became a diplomat, and then was invited back to the cabinet for a larger role. And this was a time that was so perilous. And, you know, he served during the height, the lowest point of the War of 1812, and was part of keeping the government running, to the point that at points he was the one person left in Washington, D.C. He was the one right. who was charged with handling things on the ground and, you know, having to make some snap judgments and hope that they worked out well, that the president would be okay with it. And likewise, in his tenure as Secretary of the Treasury, even though his agenda didn't get pushed through quite as much, he did achieve some institutional reforms that made the Treasury Department run more soundly. He was a person who definitely contributed to whatever success the administration could count on. He was a strong supporter of his president of the administration that was embattled basically from day one. This is a strong impact. This is a strong tenure. And especially considering that one of these two cabinet posts that he held was attorney general, which at this point, it was hard to have a big impact as attorney general. You know, the only ones that we've seen that have been really impactful previously, it's just because they had the ear of the president. You actually have an attorney general that's having to do stuff, actually having to work and trying to find more to do. I think I'm going to go for an 8 here as well.
See, I knew it. I'm changing my vote.
Going up to an 8.
I'm going up to an 8.
So with an 8 and an 8, we are at 16 for the go-getter round, and we are at 31 points total after 2 rounds. This is a very strong start.
Oh, yeah.
But now we get to the hot seat round, where we have to discuss any disgraceful behavior of or actions committed by the cabinet member. The disgrace, of course, does not have to be during their tenure of office in the cabinet. And we can each take away up to 10 points maximum.
And so I don't think I'm going to take too many away from Richard Rush. You know, it didn't sound like in any of his political posts that he was unethical or that he somehow served in an otherwise apropos manner. He was very above board. And, you know, yeah, he was a member of the American Colonization Society, but so were so many. And I think it is very indicative of the time. So I do want to put that in context. I'm going to knock him like a point, I think, for that, but only because of its kind of long-term what the society wanted to do and the support of that. I wish, being that he was such a forward thinker, I really wish he would have maybe not been a member of the ACS. But and then his kind of trying to put his finger on the scales during that whole gubernatorial race, I think, you know, as a guy who up until that point had been pretty ethical, pretty above board, that seems a little uncomfortable, just given his own history. So I think I'm gonna take away 3.
And I think I'm gonna match you in that, just because, to your point, and we see this with his participation and support of the ACS, but then also his support of the Compromise of 1850. For somebody who was so forward thinking, who was so ahead of his time in so many ways, in this instance, he doesn't recognize that the inherent racism and prejudice that he has within himself, and that's contained in organizations like the ACS, in proposals of the Compromise of 1850. He views union above all, but union for whom? He's not envisioning Black Americans in this. And so we do need to take off for that. And to your point, Alicia, getting involved in the gubernatorial race and just really throwing that bomb right in there, just, you know, just really disrupting, upending everything. And just this wishy-washy okay, well, you know, I'm a strong anti-Mason. And then 5 minutes later, oh, I'm in support of Jackson. I'm at a Masonic ritual. You know, I think that is somewhat scandalous. So, but to your point, there's not too much, you know, in terms of his public service, he by and large was above the board. He tried to do as best he could. And to the point of even realizing when the public was turning in another direction, still saying, but this is the right way to go. I've got to stand up for what's right. Right. So with -3 and -3, that's taken away 6 points. So he is at 25 points now.
Okay.
So next up is tenure of office. And so this is the entire time that a cabinet member served in a full-time capacity counted towards the points for this round. As attorney general, he served from February 10th, 1814 to November 12th, 1817. As Secretary of the Treasury, he served from March 7th, 1825 to March 5th, 1829. And so with this, with rounding out the numbers, he ends up with 8 points total in this category. And he does earn some bonus points because our cabinet members can earn bonus points if they serve in more than one cabinet post. And so he did serve in two. They can also earn a bonus point if they served in a full-time cabinet position in different presidential administrations. He definitely more than got that one.
Gets that.
He did not become president, so he does not earn that bonus point. But it's almost a wonder that he didn't somehow end up as president in one of these presidential elections. And so with that, Richard Rush ends up with 35 points total. But now, Alicia, we have to consider one more question. After all I've shared about Richard Rush's life and career and what we've discussed, do you think that this cabinet member is notable enough or impactful enough to earn a seat at the table of the cabinet all-stars?
Well, this kind of is lame because I think his career overall as a public servant is something that to be commended. And, you know, he definitely left his mark in various ways. But I don't know that they were done during, I mean, you know, as Attorney General with the laws. I know he was part of that treaty with Great Britain that lasted for over 100 years. But I'm thinking like institutionalization and what other kind of long term, tangible things or legacies that we could give him credit for as cabinet secretary specifically. That's what I'm getting hung up on. So I think wonderful public servant, definitely deserves maybe a building or a park named after him. but I'm going to say no, he does not deserve a seat at the table. Mm-mm.
I was interested to see if this was going to be the first attorney general to actually get a seat at the table. But your arguments are sound. It, you know, his legacy is really more outside of the cabinet than his tenure in the cabinet. And also, even with that legacy, you know, how well known is it? He's not really well known. Right. And notably, there are other people who are involved. So, yes, unfortunately, Richard Rush, we are going to have to say no. You do not earn a seat at this table. But I have no doubt that in the next presidential election year, you will find a seat at another table. I have no doubt that you will use it to your advantage to find another position to get into. So,
yep.
And with that, Alicia, I cannot thank you enough for joining me on what was a very wild journey through.
Whew, that was a marathon.
We covered decades of American history, of world history, European history.
Military history. We covered it all.
But I could not think of anyone better to go on this journey with and to have a conversation with. It is always a pleasure, always a joy to speak with you. And so thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. You know, I always love to come back. I love these conversations. I love being a part of these deep dives because I'll never, ever, I don't think, produce an episode of 3 hours plus. So you are an amazing scholar, an amazing podcaster, an amazing friend. And so thank you again for having me on. It was a real treat, as always.
Thank you so much. And this has probably been the longest that anybody has talked about Richard Rush in over 100 years. So, you know, at least he gets that honor. But
yes,
for our listeners, if you don't already, please go and check out Civics and Coffee anywhere fine podcasts can be found. Wherever you get your podcast, it is there. I will also have information about Civics and Coffee on the sources for this episode, as well as on my social media around the release of this episode. And Alicia and I are constantly engaging on social media, so she is not hard to find. So be sure to check it out and have a cup of coffee or tea or whatever your beverage of choice is and listen to the great insightful episodes that she launches on a weekly basis. And the fact that you can launch episodes on a weekly basis, I can't do it. I try.
Thank you so much, Jerry. I really appreciate
it. Thank you. And to all of our listeners, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for joining us on this journey. Please be sure to come back next time as we examine another cabinet member who will probably not go nearly as long or in as many twists and turns, but it will still be interesting nonetheless. And as always, until next time, stay safe and healthy, be kind to one another, and take care. Dear friend.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of the new Medal of Honor podcast from Evergreen Podcasts, brought to you in partnership with the National Medal of Honor Museum. In each 3-minute episode, we'll learn about a different service member who distinguished him or herself through an act of valor. We'll include stories from the Civil War to Iraq and Afghanistan, and from all branches of the military. We'll talk about service members who were overlooked for the medal at first due to their race or religion, and about those who were celebrated at the time. We'll hear stories of soldiers like Audie Murphy, future Hollywood star who mounted a burning tank to hold off German infantry in World War II, and people like Dr. Mary Edwards Walker, a Civil War Army doctor and the only woman to receive the Medal of Honor so far. Learn about these heroes and more wherever you get your podcasts.